When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
And welcome to another episode of Nights at the Roundtable. It's your boy Manuel, and I am joined today with Taylor Hughes. What is up, Taylor?
Hey, Manuel, thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
Bro, thanks for coming on, man. Before you guys, we get into this, man, if you're watching or if you're on YouTube, please subscribe and like so you guys can get heads up when we do this thing. But I thought it was so interesting when my assistant hit me up and was like, yo, there's this guy, Taylor, who is a former pastor, but now magician. And I was like, that segue is a little bonkers. So I was really just curious, like, A, where did you pastor at?
Yeah.
How did that start? And how did you get into what you do now?
Yeah. So my good friend Natalie listens to every episode and was like, you have to connect with what's going on here at night. So I'm so excited to crash the party.
Thanks for good, having me. Good.
I got involved in church when I was real little. At the same time, I got involved doing magic tricks. Like I had a magic kit when I was 7 years old, and I just became obsessed with this idea of wonder and being able to encourage people that, like, hey, you don't have to have it all figured out. You can just kind of enjoy the journey. And so I did magic shows growing up, and then was involved in, like, you know, youth group and church leadership when I was a kid, and was just always like putting my hand up to volunteer and to help. And sure. After a while, it was like, hey, we need someone to oversee the junior high ministry when I had gotten, you know, in college. And I was like, okay, I'll do it until you find someone. And before I knew it, I spent 13 years on staff at a church, overseeing everything from, you know, birth to college, and then getting involved with, like, you know, the worship and media side of things. And yeah, after a while, it was just one of those situations where I looked, and unfortunately we were in a scenario where leadership was, there were some challenges going on and some things that it was just like, man, you know, as a kid, I was always just like, hey, I just want to do what I feel like Jesus wants me to do. And at a certain point, the best way I could keep doing what I felt like Jesus wanted me to do was to leave the place we were at. And so I resigned my position and joined the circus.
That's the wild thing, because I think most people don't really understand. And I always tell them, because I think when you're like a audience member at a church, there's so many assumptions of like, this is how it goes down. Like, this is what's happening behind the scenes. Like, it's just like the Bible. And I always like to tell them, hey, I think nowadays church is a little bit more like a business that incorporates faith into it more than a church that handles money. At least from what I've been able to see, being behind the scenes from touring and just being a part of it for so long.
Right.
Would you say that's kind of like accurate, at least in your position?
Yeah. You know, I want to be careful that, like, I haven't been to every church environment. I mean, the 30,000 different Christian denominations, there's a lot of different ways to express your faith and worship and all of that. But in the situation that I was at, I mean, I grew up in this place for, from the time I was 8 years old, I was a member of this church. And then I spent 13 years on staff. So it was like a good chunk of my life was spent in this place. And at a certain point, you know, when you're a little kid, you don't know why decisions are made or what's happening. Right. And then I noticed that even going on staff at a church, you don't always know why the decisions are being made. The same thing happens in business. You know, we just go, well, we don't know, but leadership obviously knows, and they're making decisions that are going to help everybody and support everyone. And we just need to trust them and have faith that they're making the right decisions. And then at a certain point you get, I got involved to the point where all of a sudden I was in those meetings that I was never in before. Mm-hmm. And you start to see a little bit of kind of what's calling the shots.
Yeah.
And it was at that point where I was just like, oh, it wasn't even so much that what I believed or what I felt we were called to do changed. It was just seeing like, oh, I don't think what we say and what we do, at least in this environment I was in, lines up. And so I'd rather just kind of step away and figure out a different way to do that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think the hardest part when you do see behind the curtain is not letting it affect you or jade you in a sense of like, oh, everything that's happening is either malicious or it's easy for you to get the idea that if you were running things, you would do it better.
Yeah.
When I saw behind the scenes of what church was, I immediately just switched to, oh, okay, but it's just humans. We're doing a thing. And as we do things like usual, that ends up becoming, sometimes it gets muddy and sometimes you do things for the wrong reasons, but it never made me think that, oh, okay, this place is bad, but it just let me know like, oh man, lower your expectations. Cause I think, you know, there's disappointment up here and there's reality right here. And in between is disappointment.
Right. So yeah, absolutely.
That expectation on what you get from a church. Which I have a whole different definition now in a physical sense, what a church is for me.
Ooh, I'd love to hear it. Let's hear it.
So, I mean, I've traveled and gone to so many churches and I've moved a lot. So I've been able to be a part of different churches. And what I realized, like the church I was saved in Orlando, which I love to this day. But when I left there, you know, I didn't really hear from anyone. Right.
Yeah.
And to this day, I don't really hear from anyone.
Yeah.
And I was like, again, I didn't take that personally. I was just like, oh man, something that I thought I was doing church. I think it was like a seasonal thing and it was just doing church. And then I kept going to different churches and it was just that typical me show up. I listen, I worship, I leave. A greeter will say hi if they have a greeter ministry, but it's really just that. And when I left and went into the real world, there wasn't any more connection at that point. There wasn't any like actual life living.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just what I experienced. And again, it wasn't to be negative toward these churches. It was just more so, I think I have to develop what I saw in the Bible was the church, which was just people living in normal situations, not a building, but truly functioning as believers and as family in normal life.
Right.
All of this is spiritual.
Yes.
All of this is church. From, hey, can I help you cut your grass? Or, hey, can I help you with the groceries? Can I help pay for your kids' childcare? Like just normal, mundane, non-spiritual stuff was doing church now. And that's kind of where I exist now. I don't ever feel convicted or I don't really feel bad when people are like, do you consistently go to church? And I'm like, no, I really don't. I live in church now.
Yeah, that's so good. I mean, for me, when I was a professional believer, the biggest challenge was that I was so busy running the program of church that I never was being the church. You know, like I was the guy who'd get up on stage and would tell you like, hey, we've got this great thing going on. Come on out and be a part of it. And then I never saw my neighbors because I was just constantly at the building, you know? And so I think that some of that is just a byproduct of what we emphasize and what we make as the most important, you know? Yeah. I think anytime you make the gathering of people into a certain space more important than what's taken out of that into the world, then people just go, well, if they're not here, they must be struggling with something or, you know, they'll come back. And, you know, when we were trying to do like small groups, and it was always like, how do we get people in small groups? And then I realized one day, I'm like, everyone has a small group already.
Yep.
everyone's got a community. You got your friends, you got the people you see at the barbershop, you got your next door neighbor, you got the, you know, the parents at your kid's school. Like, everybody's got relationship. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges, I think, is that as a church, we can kind of go like, hey, let's get everybody to come to this place, and then we'll put them in a new group, rather than going, how can we empower people and encourage them just to love the people that are already in their life?
So, yeah, that's good. That's good. Because that is the thing, right? Get them all to come here, because here is where Jesus is at, as opposed to saying they're already there. Like, you're already in a growing of a church. Like, this, what you got going on, these four or five people that you, whether it's at work or whether it's your neighbors or whatever, like, this can be a church, and you just have to be the person to bring them together. And usually that exists in love. Like, at least for me, because when I was pro-Christian, it was definitely, I was professional Christian. Sorry, I didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, pro anti-Christian.
Oh, no, I got you.
I was super hardcore. Like, I was out witnessing. Mm-hmm. I was on the streets, and I was, you know, I was that guy.
Yeah.
And then I never really had any conversion, and it wasn't for lack of scripture, because I had so much scripture to throw at people.
Right.
But it was more so that I bypassed their life and where they were at now.
Yeah.
Just so that I can give them what I thought was the most important thing that they needed. Cause that's the teaching. And I know deep down we believe, yes, Jesus is the most important thing, but in somebody's life, A, that doesn't know Jesus, B, that has real world problems, not spiritual stuff.
Yeah.
Real world. I can't eat. My kids don't have clothes, like real world problems.
Yeah.
To me, it felt more authentically Jesus to address those real world problems first.
I mean, that's what we see in the stories, right? That's what you see in the scripture of Jesus. He was like on his way somewhere, and someone interrupted him, and that became the mission. You know what I mean? Like, someone needs something. Let's take care of that. I've always struggled a little bit with I saw you guys did a conversation recently on hell, which is like a big heavy topic in the church. And I think the thing that I struggle with, regardless of what you think is going to happen someday, undeniably there are people right now who are experiencing hellish conditions.
Right.
And I think, you know, like you said, when you're kind of being like that young, passionate, I got to tell people about Jesus, because we're afraid of what's going to maybe happen to them someday. We're forgetting that we have the opportunity right now. And this is what I see in the story of Jesus, like, he did it right there. It wasn't like someday, like right now, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Like, let's help someone right now, so that we help them not experience
Isn't
that.
It's such a weird way of thinking of things. It's like you're living for a future that you don't even know, like, what it is, what it looks like. You have an idea. Like, our idea of hell is, I feel, was more influenced by Dante's Inferno and a lot of other religions who also have a Satan character in their religions. We've been influenced by it. And now we're like living, judging, like oppressing people based on a future that we all can only hope is a certain thing. Like, we hear Streets of Gold, but I literally, to this day, and I've been saying for a long time, I couldn't even draw you a picture of what I really thought heaven was. I have an idea. I have an idea, but even that idea, I'm like, this is such a 50-50. I don't know what it is, but what I do know is, like, what you're saying. Like, I'm living in a very real world right now, and I have the ability to help people right now.
Yeah, let's do it.
I was studying these rabbis, and they were saying, like, you know, hell for them wasn't the lake, it wasn't this fire, wasn't this whatever. It was the brutal understanding of all that you could have done in life, but you didn't do.
Yeah. Like, you missed out on the opportunity.
Yeah.
It was right in front of you. Yeah.
Well, the anguish of that is hell. Mm. And when I said that, even when I first heard it, I was like, well, that doesn't seem like scary. Like, well, that doesn't seem at all like I just fixed my life for that.
Right.
And then he, which, you know, coincidentally, the interviewer said the same thing. He was like, well, that doesn't seem scary. So why would anybody choose, you know, Jesus?
Right. Right.
And he was like, well, think about suicide, or, you know, think about taking one's life. Do most people choose that road because of something that happened to them physically, or because of what's happening in their minds. And I was just like, dang, you're so right. Most of what happens in the mind. And then it formulates how you see what's happening in reality. So you may think nobody loves you, even though there's a whole family that's behind you. And I love you. Right. If you need me, reach out. But your mind is telling you, no one is there. I'm alone.
Yeah.
And so the battlefield happens up here. Mm-hmm. So his point was, this is the worst. This can turn your life into heaven or hell.
Yeah.
And I was blown away by that idea. Like, he framed the way I looked at everything.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. That's a really good way to look at it.
Yeah.
And the fact that when you look at, okay, if your desire is to help other people and people are suffering with mental health issues and they're struggling with physical pain, you know, when you're dealing with something that is so huge like that, it's all you can see. You're not thinking about the future. You know, you're not thinking about 5 years from now. You're definitely not thinking about eternity.
Right.
And yet we put all this emphasis on, hey, everything's going to be better when you're gone, you know, as opposed to what can I do to make things a little bit better today?
Right.
I'm not saying they're mutually exclusive. Like, you know, if your conviction is that like, we need to help people be secure for eternity, then yeah, it'd be wrong for you not to do everything you could to help people in that way. However, don't step over the need today in an effort to try to like, save Sell somebody from future. Right. possible pain down the road. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so when you ended up transitioning out, like what was that period like? Cause I don't know about you, but I mean, I guess I had an excuse of why I was gone from church so much because I was touring. So usually if I'm touring, I'm at a show.
Right.
On Sunday,
people ask, where do you go to church? And you're like, oh, you know, I'm on the road all the time.
I'm not there serving Jesus 24/7.
Right.
But when I stopped doing it and I found myself on this side of things, a large part of me felt like when I walked away, what I would call systematic Christianity, you know, like the mainstream idea of what it meant to do these things.
Yeah.
I found myself kind of like scared because I was like, oh no, I used to have a church that gave me my walls.
Right.
Or politely put me into the box that they put everyone else in. And so I knew my limits. Now I'm out here in the real world talking about Jesus is everywhere and I could find him anywhere. And the church is here now outside of every wall. And now I'm forced to find my own walls or build my own safety nets because now you can just live like a hooligan. It's like, you have to start building your own fortress of like, all right, I can't go there. I gotta be smart. Like I can't go there. I have freedom, but I can't go there. So what did that look like for you from being like, so invested in the church system to now you're on your own?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I heard someone describe it once, like your beliefs and the kind of like those, here's who I am, here's what I'm about, this is what I'll do, this is what I won't do. It's kind of like when you first move into your first apartment. Like, you remember your first apartment you ever had?
Yeah.
And the furniture that you had was like, you know, it's like an old couch you found on the side of the road. And you're like, I'll flip the cushion over. It's not that gross, you know? And then like, you had like something got passed down to you from your grandma. And then you had those dishes that, you know, someone was throwing away. And so you get to a point, like when you first start jumping out in the world where you look around, you go like, oh, all these beliefs that I have that I say are mine. So many of them have been like borrowed and stolen and passed down and placed upon you from other people. And so I think there's an initial for a lot of people who are, and the word deconstruction gets a weird, it's a loaded thing. But I think about like, hey, if you're going to remodel, you got to have demo day. Like there's a time where it's like, we got to get all this stuff out so we can figure out what we're putting in.
Yeah.
And I think for me, a lot of that was like, okay, let's clear out. There's like a season where I'm like, I don't even know what I believe anymore because everything that I have been taught has been attached to a place that then when it all hit the fan was not there for me, you know, like, and so for a minute, you kind of like get all the furniture out of here. Let's just clear the space. And then you start going, well, that one I really like, I'm going to put that back in. And this one doesn't really serve me. So I'm going to go find another one that connects with me more and helps me love people more, you know? So I think that there is for everybody when they step away from an environment that maybe wasn't the most life-giving for them, or maybe for a time was, and then it started to take away. there is that moment where you kind of go like, okay, who is it that I want to be? And what is it that I want my life to be about? And so I think it's very beyond natural. I think it's necessary to have kind of a clearing of those parameters.
Yeah.
You know?
And yeah. So I mean, that's beautiful right there. How you just said it.
I think a lot of time people will look, I mean, I'll just say, I'll speak from my perspective. When I was a pastor and people would leave, I'd go like, they're just hurt. They'll be back.
Yeah.
They'll be back. Right. Yeah. As opposed to, you know, when you see an image in scripture of like somebody hurting, you know, it's like Jesus, the good shepherd, he's going to go after the one who is lost, you know, mm-hmm. and we're just like, nah, they'll find their way back.
Yeah.
If they're a real believer.
Yeah. Yeah. Or so, we'll have a lot of negative things to say about the amount of times I heard the term backsliding, and I was like, I still have yet to find this in the Bible, but it's
not there.
We really holding on to. And I mean, I think, man, you said it so simple and so eloquently, like, cause we called it remodeling too. Cause I do real estate on the side, and I'm like,
yeah,
there's no way to know like what you have and what's working and what's not. If the electrical's old, or if the pipes need new, like, I think with the idea of deconstruction, you know, I think the reason it's a trigger, like most political, this would consider a spiritual political term. Yeah. To where it divides people really quickly, because they immediately look at the extremes of each thing. So when you hear deconstruction, you think of the extremes. You think of somebody who doesn't love the Bible, doesn't love God. They just want to be out here living how they want to live.
Right.
And for most of us that are going through it or have done it, it's really like what you said. It is a nice remodel of, all right, what is working in this house and what is not?
Yes.
Where did I buy from cheap, mm-hmm. you know, places? And what do I need to replace with good quality stuff to make this house work?
Right. You know, when you grow
up, it's beautiful.
Oh man, you're spot on. I mean, when you grow up, you kind of don't have, like, a kid doesn't have political beliefs when they're 4 years old.
Right.
But they hear what their parents say. And they don't have religious beliefs when they're teeny tiny. They just, you enter into a worldview that you didn't build, right? Mm-hmm. All of us do. We're just born into a situation. Some of us are born into a situation where there is no belief in God, and people find that later. And sometimes it's the other way around.
Right.
But I think about it like when I was a kid, my dad's always loved classic cars. Like he had a 1954 Chevy when I was like little.
Yeah.
And I mean, we had like nine different, not at the same time. He would like buy them, sell them, trade them. Like, you know, at one point we had like, you know, we've had nine different classic cars growing up. We never had a Ford because my dad just loved Chevys. He just loved Chevys. We would go to the car show or the swap meet, and he'd be like, come, let me show you this one. And because he loved Chevys, he taught me about Chevrolets.
Right.
Like I could tell you any Chevy from the 50s, I could tell you what year it is by the taillight, because when I was a kid, my dad thought it was so important for me to see that information, and his love for that thing made me retain it, right? Mm. And then I realized years later, like I had this attitude of like, "Oh, Fords are terrible. Fords are awful." And then I drove like a couple Fords and I'm like, "Hey, some of these are pretty great."
Yeah. Yeah.
And all I knew is that my dad hated Fords. And he loved Chevys. And so I adopted that belief without ever exploring for myself that, yeah, Chevys are great, but there's also some great things about Fords. Mm. And I think we do the same thing with our political views, with our religious views, where we like join a team, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, if sports is great, but it doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, it, I mean, to have a team where we're just like, we're the best always. Now the team's always changing.
Right, right.
Right. Yeah. Different players, different plays, but we're just like, these are our guys, and they're our guys. Well, no, these are the guys that we paid to come here and will leave us.
You know,
but we can kind of do the same thing with our political views and our spiritual views, where we just adopt whatever was handed to us. And then the question is it deconstruction what you believe, or is it really for the first time thinking about what you believe and owning it? Yeah. I think that's kind of beautiful.
It's a thinking on your own process. It's like the first time that you've actually stopped and said, why? And it's funny because, you know, most people, or I guess traditional church going people will consider the questioning a bad thing, because it means that you have doubt. It means that you're somehow unsure of your faith. And I used to think that the more I can consider myself being right, mm-hmm. the more certain I was in my faith, because I'm learning so much. So I know more. I know more. And now I'm certain.
Yeah.
But then life has this funny way of just teaching me that I don't know anything.
Yeah.
And I think the most beautiful part of my deconstruction and reconstruction would be that I no longer desire to be right. Because with being right and being staunch and being so like so whatever certain, then now you carry the obligation, now you carry the weight of needing to be factual in everything that you are and say. So if somebody proves you wrong, you're gonna get everyone just slamming on you like, oh, I thought you knew. I thought you were right. Yeah. And so that's happened to me a couple of times. Nobody came and slammed on me. I slammed on myself. And I realized, man, it's not worth sticking so tight or so hard to a certain point when there's so many other things that it could be. So I lost the idea of being right. And I welcomed the mystery of Jesus and the mystery of the gospel. Mm-hmm. I was just having a conversation with my boy yesterday, and we were talking about, which is interesting. We were talking about adultery.
Hmm.
And I always thought it was interesting in the Jewish culture that most of the times, if not all of the times, the men never got in trouble for adultery.
Hmm.
It was the women that got in trouble. So when the woman was going to be stoned and Jesus came in,
called
the men and was like, which one of you? Cast the first stone if you don't have no sin.
Yeah.
But none of those people was crying for the dude that she had, you know, that she slept with.
Interesting.
And culturally speaking, it was usually the woman that was punished for it. And so when we were talking about adultery, I was like, man, I really think that adultery meant something different back then than it did, like how we use it today. Like when we say it now in America, it's very specific. But back then, it had different language, a different category. It was just different.
Hmm.
And I didn't land on an answer because I'm waiting to go back and study it to see what it is. Just to study the idea of language and a Jewish perspective so that I can really reframe the way I look at this book and how I move forward. Because that really was important to me too. I realized I'm reading this from an American point of view.
Right.
This is a Jewish book.
Yeah. So
if I don't know Jewish ways of looking at things, then I cannot accurately put this into my life right now.
Yeah, that's so good. I love that idea of, I mean, one question I like to ask people is what was the last thing you changed your mind about?
Mm.
You know, I think, as a kid, you know, you learn to tie your shoes. And do you remember, like, even if you can't remember learning yourself, if you've ever watched a kid learning to tie their shoes,
right?
The amount of intensity with every movement and the frustration and the struggle and feeling like I'm never going to get this.
Right.
I'm never going to get this. And yet at one point we all, like today, we put our shoes on, we tied them. We didn't think twice about it. You didn't even think, you're probably doing two other things while you're tying your shoes.
Yeah.
Because we've now put that tying shoes in the category of knowing. We've got it down. We know it. So we're never going to think about it again.
Yeah.
And I think people do that spiritually where they go, well, this is what the pastor said. Now I know it. I'm going to put that in the knowing category. And we don't open ourselves up to any other perspectives or ideas. And I just think that, you know, as a kid learning magic tricks, the thing that attracted me to magic and the reason I use magic as a metaphor when I speak now is that there's something beautiful about showing someone something that they don't understand.
Mm.
Because we live in a world where we have instant access to all information.
Yeah.
Like we have forgot what it feels like to not know something because we don't sit in it. We just immediately Google, right?
Yeah.
And so when you can show somebody something that they don't understand, it like flips a switch in our brains where we go like, oh, maybe there's some other things that I don't understand. And so for me, like when you talk about not feeling like you have to have it all figured out, that is beautiful, man. Like I feel like there is so much in scripture about awe and wonder and reverence and like being amazed at God. And I think anytime people start to go like, we've got the lock on who God is, like, you know, this book that people have been fighting about for thousands of years and was written over all this time by all these different people, we finally cracked the code.
Right.
So just listen to what we say and do it, and it's all going to work out.
Right. You know? I laugh about that all the time. I'm like, guys, like really, and this was the conversation I was having with them. I was like, you have to at least admit that all of your study, all of your learning is so far removed from the time that it actually took place that at least come to the agreement that we are all 50-50 right and wrong.
Right.
All we have is best guess. And I'll get fight on that. But when I ask a couple more questions, you know, you can tell me all that you have learned. And then if I ask you, hey, but are you 1,000% that your interpretation is fully without error?
Yeah.
And no one has been able to say yes, because they wouldn't, because in reality, all we have are really good guesses.
Yeah.
So if that's going to be the fact, then why not be more humble in this idea of this book? And that's kind of like the stance I took. I'm like, all right, cool. Whenever I have conversations with people, I start with, hey, do you believe you're 1,000% correct and there's no error in your interpretation of this book? No. Yeah. Okay, me either. So from here on out, we're novices.
Yeah.
We're just novices having a conversation about a book that we think is cool.
Right.
And moving forward, that kind of takes the ego and the pride out of everything. Thanks so much, y'all, for listening to part one of this episode. We appreciate it greatly. Hey, like and subscribe if you guys are feeling this. Share it with your friends. We appreciate it so much. Please come back next week for part two. Love you.